Hello, this is Jim Brown speaking with a special edition of my Outrigged Capercast. This is number 53. We're just a year into this thing now. And this time we have no theme music. Try to imagine in the background Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man. For I'm here this time to announce the passing of Meade Guzon, who died Sunday afternoon, August 27th. 2017. Perhaps the most uncommon man I've ever known, but he and his brothers were the founders of West System brand epoxy products, which have since about 1972 changed the way boats are built and maintained by developing a whole new realm of craftsmanship that has stimulated so many hundreds of thousands of us to undertake the fulfillment of building and maintaining our own boats and forming and maintaining our own boating friendships. So in this caper, and maybe the next, I'm going to speak of my own personal friendship with Meade Guzon and try to illuminate the very bright stripe that he has painted on the waters of the world for all of us to follow. Meade and his brothers came up from middle-class beginnings at the south end of Saginaw Bay called Bay City, Michigan. And they got into sailing as kids, particularly in ice boats. To avoid getting stuck in family details, I'm going to jump way ahead until the late 1960s when they all found themselves back home in Bay City, Michigan after the Vietnam War. Brother Joel had been a flying ace with over 120 combat missions. Jan, the youngest, was in a construction battalion because he was the only guy in the group that knew how to actually construct. And Meade was actually in and out of the Army before the beginning of the Vietnam War. He had spent his time teaching English to nearly illiterate inductees. And he tells the story of going down to his ice boat, which had been stowed outside and was neglected for years, and it looked like it was pretty feeble. He opened up an inspection hatch, stuck his nose inside, and all of a sudden his glasses fogged up. At that point, he realized that their boats were getting stewed to death from the inside. A little water had gotten in through the hatch, the water vapor couldn't get out in sufficient volume, and the water vapor was permeating the wood from inside. And that experience was fundamental to their developing this epoxy product that would be a serious moisture barrier, whether inside or outside. It would also become a fabulous adhesive, requiring no clamping pressure on the joints, and even able to span gaps in glue joints. And it was a tremendous adhesive. It would stick to wood and other things, even metal, with a very tenacious bond. And that's explained by the fact that unlike other adhesives, which all shrink during cure, epoxy does its shrinking while it's still fluid or in a gel state, whereas other adhesives continue to shrink after they've turned solid, which in effect, in a microscopic way, pulls them away from the very surfaces to which they're trying to bond. That's the basic difference in epoxy. It sticks because it doesn't shrink after cure. And of course, in the years since, they have developed other epoxy products, especially for use on other materials besides wood. Fiberglass, a carbon fiber, foam cores, the honeycomb cores. They have production resins now that are used in a wide variety of applications in industry, including boat building. Their products and their know-how are worldwide acknowledged as being among the world's leaders in so-called composite construction materials, advanced materials. But let's go back to the late 60s, early 70s, when I was trying to finish our plywood trimaran Scrimshaw, building it in a rainforest in the bottom of a canyon on the California coast. And of course, in those days, we used good old Weldwood glue, a water mix stuff, and polyester resin for the glass job, and so on. rock-bottom economy materials throughout, and by now what had happened is that all three brothers had come home. Meade, who was trying to make a living building ice boats in a little tin shed down by the Saginaw River, and Jan came home, got a job working for another boat builder nearby, and that guy knew that a crude form of epoxy was being used by the Detroit automaker pattern makers. They were gluing big blocks of wood together in order to sculpt the bodies of automobiles, but it was like trying to work with cold honey and hot tar. The two ingredients were really thick and heavy. And I may not have the sequence correct here, but as I recall, Meade was having more ice boat orders than he could handle, so he asked their old high school friend J.R. Watson to come and help. Jan was racing ice boats, turned out to be five times world champion in DN ice boats. So Meade and J.R. Watson got too busy. Jan came over and started to work with them and brought epoxy with him. The stuff was so difficult to work with that they were thinning it out with acetone. Now, ice boating was very popular on Saginaw Bay in the wintertime, and it happened that one of the enthusiasts was a guy, I think his name was Herb Dow. He was the grandson of one of the founders of the Dow Chemical Corporation, which was located near town. So Herb came in, ordered an ice boat, and noticed that they were using epoxy and having a devil of a time with it, and he said, "Oh, that stuff, come on out to the laboratory. I'll put you in touch with so-and-so. He'll tell you about how to use that stuff." So Meade and Jan began to learn about reactive diluents and flowing agents, stuff that would be mixed in with the epoxy but not flash off in the form of vapor during cure, leaving microscopic holes for water vapor to get through. Instead, these reactive diluents became a part of the final cured product as a constituent of the resin. So now they began to use epoxy for building ice boats in ways other than just as a glue. They were using it as a coating on the insides of the little fuselage of these boats. They could also use it as the matrix for saturating fiberglass cloth to put on the outside of these boats. And they began to experiment, especially Jan, experimented with mixing in other fibers and fillers in order to come up with a regular Julia Child assortment of muds and putties that could be particularly formulated for each application. They were learning how to either make the stuff stronger or lighter or more easily sanded, more easily sculpted into shape, consistencies that would vary anything from something like half and half on up through maple syrup, then to mayonnaise, and then to peanut butter in consistency so that the stuff could really be handled in a wide variety of applications. So all of a sudden, they were able to build some very good ice boats out of this stuff. Also, ice boating is responsible for a lot of crack-ups on the race course, and so they were performing ice boat repairs that no one else could accomplish because they didn't have epoxy. The competition began to realize that these guys had a secret weapon, and so they started coming around to the back door of the shop with their mason jars in their hands trying to buy this stuff. So they started selling epoxy out the back door, and of course the guys that bought it didn't really know how to use it. They didn't have the experience that had already been accumulated in the Goujon shop. And so when they went to work, they kept calling and asking for advice. The phone was ringing off of the wall. They couldn't get anything done. So they finally turned the telephone over to J.R. Watson, and he became their first technical consultant. And ever since, it has been their policy to distribute the know-how as well as the product. They started with a simple user's guide that went out with every order. They eventually published a monumental tome, The Goujon Brothers on Boat Building, still the reference book on the subject. And for years, they've published a biannual periodical called Epoxy Works, which features an enormous variety of projects and applications that are submitted to them by the users of the products. Just as soon as they could afford it, they hired an adhesives engineer, this guy Bill Bertelsen. They set up a laboratory and began a years-long testing program for determining the physical properties of the stuff and also for modifying the formulation of the products. Now, I'm not going to get carried away with plugs for West System Epoxy. That's not the point. The point of this whole podcast is stories, right? And I'm going to get back to the personal stories. But personally speaking, Mead Guzon guided that company in a very high level of ethical attempt at perfection. Everything they did, not just with their product and their boats, but with their people and with their friends, was done as perfectly as humanly possible. Knowing that perfection can only be approached, Mead did his level best for his whole life long. Well, getting back to the 1970s now, at about the time Mead and Jan were selling epoxy in mason jars out the back door of their shop, I was trying to finish Scrimshaw in California. She was built with rock-bottom economy materials for the day, you know, exterior grade plywood, not marine, a lot of weldwood glue, the water mix variety stuff, and polyester for the glass job. And I nearly had her finished. We were getting pretty close to being able to dump our business on our friends and take off on our big deal family boat ride. And I began hearing about this epoxy stuff. And one day I received in the mail a bunch of samples of the way that epoxy could be used in Sea Runner trimarans. Somebody, I'll never know who now, I think it was Jan, built an example of every joint in a Sea Runner trimaran that could be made with epoxy, including our so-called molded chines, which were unique to Sea Runner construction. And these samples were beautiful. They were no bigger than a loaf of bread, but they were elegantly finished with the epoxy, the corners rounded and everything glossy. It was just an incredible box full of stuff. And in there was a note that said, we suggest that you destroy these samples in order to convince yourself of the efficacy of our product. So with great reluctance, I put them up on the workbench and bashed them all to pieces with the splitting maul. And in every case, the epoxy filler materials, the filleting and sculpting materials, and the glue joints, they all survived far better than the wood that was in the samples. So I ordered a gallon of this stuff. I was building Scrimshaw's rudder. It's about all I did with epoxy for the first time on Scrimshaw was to build the rudder with it. So we put the boat in the water and hopped in and took off and didn't come back for 3 years. Finally ended up in Virginia, of course, you've heard the story. And I was pleased to learn that there were hundreds of people building Sea Runner trimarans. And I was a bit jolted to learn that some of our builders were using epoxy by the drum. So I figured I'd better come up to speed on this stuff. And I made a cassette tape recording, a long letter to Mead Guzon, asking him to educate me as to what was going on. And I received a tape recording back from Mead. And at the end of it, we realized that we were a couple of guys who were probably going to really get to know each other. Now that was 1975, and the next year, of course, 76, is when Charles Chiodi, editor of Multihulls magazine, struck up a deal with Jillian and Pat McGrath, who were our plans agents and the agents for many multihull designers in Canada. And they set up the first World Multihull Symposium, Toronto, 1976. They were able to get sponsorships from a tobacco company, of all things. And they brought in all the designers that had any participation on a commercial level with multihulls at that time. And many of us had never met each other. You know, Lock Crowther came from Australia, and Rod McAlpin Downey came from England. James Warham was there with two of his wives. We had a big convention center auditorium. There were like 300 and 50 people had come from all over the world to attend this thing. And of course, Meade and Jan were there, and there was a very lively, sometimes heated exchange between the designers and the audience. Very emotional crowd. Tremendous enthusiasm for the subject. And the three-day schedule of seminars was organized so that we spent a fair amount of time on construction. And of course, the talk came around to epoxy, and the point was made that it was important to do this kind of boat building with dry wood. And one of the questions from the audience was, how do you know when your wood is dry? And Meade got up and said, well, you know, when you buy sandpaper, if you get good fresh sandpaper and you fold a sheet of it, it cracks, huh? And so to tell if your wood is dry, put a sheet of sandpaper in between a few pieces of it at night, and in the morning, take out the sandpaper, fold it again. If it cracks, your wood is dry. And all at once I realized that these guys were the real thing. They were on the level of my level and the level of my owner builders. And one night after dinner, Meade invited a few people to come up to his motel room. Well, the place was really crowded in the end. They were going to give a little demonstration of, the advantages of wood as a modern engineering material. At the time, in the shop, they were building a 25-foot A-class catamaran for the Little America's Cup, and they were doing a little beach racing, because also at the symposium was one of their competitors, Alex Kozloff, was building one of the competing catamarans for the Little America's Cup. Well, I'm not sure of the timing of the name now. I think maybe the Little America's Cup hadn't really gotten started at that time, but it was the A-class catamaran championships that was at stake here, and Alex Kozloff's boat was being built of anything but wood, composite materials, foam glass. And so Meade opened up his briefcase and took out a bunch of little samples that he had made, and he had a very clever hands-on test that he was able to illustrate just how stiff wood was for its weight. And he explained that stiffness was the real problem when designing a hull. If the hull was going to be stiff enough to resist panting loads, oil canning and panting loads from hydrostatic, hydrodynamic, and slamming loads, if it was going to be stiff enough, it was certainly going to be strong enough. Stiffness as opposed to strength. Stiffness measures its ability to hold its shape, whereas strength is to resist breakage. So Meade's point, and it always has been his point, is that by using wood together with epoxy, one can come up with a structure that is extremely light and stiff, and therefore plenty strong, for lots less money than with modern composite materials. So after he'd gone through his dog and pony show, Alex Kozloff, who was reclining on one of the beds, said, well, okay, so wood is good stuff, okay? I believe you, but tell me what's wrong with wood. What don't you like about it? And over in the corner was Jan, who had been silent during this whole thing, and he spoke up. He said, you gotta keep it dry, man. He always said dry wood is twice as strong as wet wood, and all you have to do is convince yourself by using a toothpick. Poke around in your mouth a little bit with a piece of dry wood and let it get wet, then test its strength, especially its stiffness. And so right there we have the primary reason why the Guzan brothers were successful in their technological approach to boat building, which included, at that time, not just wood, but fiberglass, carbon fiber, other materials, but used in conjunction with wood. And now the whole multi-hull phenomenon was being supported mostly by owner-builders building their own boats for cruising and racing. And here was a technology that used carpenter's tools and painter's tools in order to produce very sophisticated structures. And it was that know-how that largely drove the multi-hull phenomenon, and other lightweight boats. All lightweight seafaring boats benefited from epoxy in some way through the 70s and 80s. And it wasn't until production multi-hull boat building came along that fiberglass and foam began to take over the marketplace. And in my view, the only reason that happened was that wood was hard to put into a mold for production. Popping out multiple boats of the same shape was the only way to make any money, and very few people did in production multi-hulls. That's another story. But the one I want to tell you now is about sailing with Meade Guzan. This story starts with Dick Newick. He was another guy. At the MultiHealth Symposium in 76, Dick and I had corresponded for years, but we had never met. Well, we surely met at the symposium, and the next summer, we packed up Scrimshaw and sailed from Virginia up to New England and had a visit with the Newicks where they were living then on Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. And it was there that we met his clients, Phil and Ann Weld. These were wonderful, cultured people, and they had a 60-foot trimaran designed by Dick Newick called the Gulf Streamer. And Phil was regularly driving her back and forth across the Atlantic to take part in races in Europe. And it was the Gulf Stream that claimed Gulf Streamer. They were crossing the north wall of the Gulf Stream in rather heavy weather, Phil and an inexperienced crewman. Phil was off watch below. The guy on the helm heard that freight train roar, looked behind, saw what he described as a 40-foot double-crested wave. It scared the daylights out of him. He dropped the wheel and went down below. The boat broached under the face of this rogue wave and was capsized. The guy just didn't know that if he had steered the boat away from the wave, it probably would have surfed ahead of it to the point where there was, a happy ending to the story. But they spent 4 days in the upturned vessel. They did have a dry compartment in the inverted position and a dry sleeping bag. They were able to chop a hole in the bottom, stand watch, hail a passing freighter, and get picked up. The boat was later picked up by a Russian freighter, taken to Odessa, and revived, was returned to the water. And in fact, Phil and Dick had the opportunity to consult with the Russians to put the boat back in some shape. I don't think she ever was campaigned again. But anyway, Phil and Ann Weld were in the position of having to replace their vessel. And I just happened to be there at Phil and Ann's home in Gloucester, Massachusetts, when Phil and Dick were talking about what to do for another boat. It wanted to be very much like Gulfstreamer, but they did not have a builder. Well, I happened to be speaking with Phil alone about it, and I said, gee, you might consider the Guzon brothers in Michigan. And Phil said, well, I'm not sure I would want a wooden boat. And Dick and I both got in on it and said, well, there's this new technology, this epoxy stuff. We could probably get you a pretty nice boat built out of wood. Well, that's the way it happened. It was built in the Guzon shop in Bay City and taken out through St. Lawrence and down to the Caribbean. And the next year, I guess it was the winter of 1978 or 9, that Phil was putting together a crew for competing in the Tradewinds race, which is no longer run, but it was a great event. It was a 900-mile dash around the Lesser Antilles, which is the finest place to sail in the world. And I was delighted to be invited to join the crew, and so was Meade. So we joined the boat at St. Mark, and Meade stowed his duffel aboard and came out in swim trunks, walked over to the float stern and said, okay, fellas, this is going to be my first taste of salt water. He dove off, came up spluttering brine, and I was absolutely flabbergasted. Here was this guy who had just built what I considered to be the finest ocean-going multi-hull in the world, and he had never been to sea. Well, it didn't take long for me to realize he had certainly been to school in the Great Lakes. And on this race, which we won, incidentally, Meade and I had a chance to share a few night watches when we could really talk with each other. And so here we were in this real ocean greyhound booming through the Caribbean in the moonlight. Speeds in the mid to upper teens were common, spray flying off of the lee bow to the point where it didn't even come down sometimes for a boat length or two. We were power reaching against, trade wind waves rolling in all the way from Africa, 7 to 9 footers, most of them white horses. And because it was because of the Newick design that we were able to go so very fast in such very rough water. And I began to express my concerns to Meade about the structural loads we were putting on the boat. I mean, the thing was just slashing through these waves. And he replied that the reason he could do it, that she could do it, was of her very light weight. They had launched that boat, a 60-foot trimaran, at something just less than 10,000 pounds in structured weight. And because of the boat's extreme slicing configuration in its hulls and in its wing decks, the wing decks could chop the top off of waves. Because of the way Dick had shaped them, but the boat could also respond quickly to big chunks of solid water. And that combination was just an incredible thing to watch. You know, trade winds come through in waves. That is, the wind itself goes up and down. It's relatively steady, but up and down to the extent that at times this boat was driven so hard by a wind force increase that she would simply sail out ahead of her gust. Meaning that when the boat speed would get up to the 20-knot range, if the helmsman were to hold the course, the apparent wind would pull around ahead to the point where the sails would feather. They would tend to spill some of the excess power, and yet when the wind would drop back to its usual 16 or 18 knots, the boat was properly trimmed for driving on at full speed. So it was her ability to sail ahead in spurts, even when going against the wind, that relieved stress at the right time. And of course, Mead and I agreed that if we had been running downwind and a big nasty wave were to curl up from astern, if there was somebody on the helm, the boat would have simply run away from it. Well, it was at about that time that I was developing the constant camber system of boat building, which of course used a lot of epoxy. And Mead was very helpful to us in convincing us that we were just set up for going into vacuum bagging. And at that point, my career took quite a left turn. I went off into those overseas boat building training projects where we used constant camber and epoxy. So during that time, I had a chance to visit the glue factory in Michigan a time or three and really got to know the Goujon brothers and see their operation. And all through the 80s and 90s, the brothers continued with their boat building. They built some remarkable vessels, got into manufacturing windmill blades, a whole nother story. They manufactured the G-32, a remarkable 32-foot catamaran, one of which my son Russell now owns and has recently managed to triumph in the single-handed level in the race to Alaska just this spring. And incidentally, one of Russell's old friends in the pro department, Lou McGregor, has also just acquired a G-32. But through the 90s and into the 2000s, Mead and I had a chance to spend some time together now and then. He bought a little motor home, and we had a chance to make a couple of trips together. One down the Pacific coast from Port Townsend, Washington to San Francisco, and another down the Atlantic coast from Maine to Virginia. And the Pacific trip started right after the Port Townsend Wooden Boat Festival, where he and I made a presentation entitled, Why Wood Now? A lot of good reasons. And I think, why wood in the future? A lot of good reasons, too. But anyway, on that trip, as we moseyed our way down the coast, stopping in every boat shop and marina we could find, one of the purposes was for me to plug his new product, G-Flex. It's a real game changer in the epoxy lineup. It's fairly flexible and it'll stick to wet wood. And it'll allow big chunks of wood to go through deep moisture cycling, where it changes its dimensions substantially between extreme wet and extreme dry. And because the glue line is a little flexible, the glue joints will survive that kind of treatment, which epoxy normally did not. Epoxy would survive it, but the wood would not. Anyway, we'd go into some big marine hardware store, and he would introduce himself at the cash register and offer some little samples of this G-Flex stuff, and all of a sudden the place people would scurry and try to find management, and Mead and I'd walk around and look at the inventory and so on, and then he'd put on another little dog and pony show, and I'd tell a sea story, and we'd get back in the motorhome and continue on. We got to Crescent City at the very north end of California there, and Mead was kept remarking about the size of the redwood trees. I realized he had never seen the redwoods. Here was this guy that was the monk, I mean, really the pope of wood, and he'd never seen the redwoods. So we diverted inland a ways to what they call the Avenue of the Giants. I had been there before, and my gosh, it really is a spiritual experience. And Meade was absolutely flabbergasted by these things. What he enjoyed most was we found one tree had a little sign on it. It had been down for about 2,000 years, and it was still intact. Of course, all the bark and the sapwood and everything was gone, but the redwood core of the log was still lying there on the forest floor. And there was another redwood tree. Apparently a seedling had sprouted on the bark of this decaying tree, and its roots had reached over into the ground. And now here was another 2,000-year-old redwood tree growing on top of its downed forebear. Me just couldn't get over that. He talked a lot about the redwoods about the lightest weight of the conifers, and the reason they could get so big, he said, was because they were not too heavy for them to hold themselves up. And redwood laminates made with epoxy are wonderful stuff. It's just that the thin slices of redwood are kind of hard to handle because the wood is easily split. And the western red cedar is not quite so splitty, and so it's the preferred species for strip planking and coal molding. Anyway, we continued our travels on down the western seaboard to San Francisco, whereupon Meade called his wife and said, "Hey, Janet, you got to jump on a plane to come out here. I want to take you up and show you the redwoods." And they did that. Well, speaking of Janet, there's another thing. My God, what a family. They have 3 of their own children and 7 adopted. They've been sweethearts from grade school. Meade sometimes called her Goldilocks. A wonderful blonde Mama Goujon. Well, as usual, I'm talking too much here, but I'm going to go on to a conclusion, hoping you can push the pause button, come back later perhaps, but I want to make this story complete for myself, if for nobody else. Going on into the 2000s, and both Meade and Jan were able to acquire wintertime homes on the west coast of Florida. And my friend Andy Zimmerman and I began to attend the gathering at Cedar Key, an annual shindig there at a little beach town straight west of Gainesville, where they have the annual Cedar Key Small Boat Event. I've spoken of it before. It's a wonderful gathering. No regatta, no prizes, no protest meetings, no nothing. It's just a bunch of people with trailerable boats getting together to schmooze for a long weekend. And, of course, Meade and Jan would always show up with their latest creations, marvelous vessels, extremely inventive boats that they brought to this Cedar Key event. And Andy Zimmerman, who manufactured my Windrider designs, we'd always rent a couple of condos and put on a big dinner, and it was really just a great time to hang around and schmooze with Meade. He lost his brother Jan a few years ago, who died of respiratory difficulties, and Meade kept competing in the Everglades Challenge, which is that crazy race, and I actually had a chance to see Meade twice this spring, once at the finish of the Everglades Challenge. And it was on that occasion that he had a chance to see Randy Smythe's hybrid wing rig. It was there at the finish of the race this spring that Meade said, "That's the greatest advance in sailing in 100 years." And then, of course, I also saw him at Cedar Key. And he had been battling skin cancers for several years, had several of them removed surgically, and his doctor really cautioned him about going out in the sun, but he just really did not want to give up his Florida time and his boating time, so he would show up in the sunny times with extreme protection, a big floppy hat, his face in total white face with aluminum oxide, and long sleeves, long pants, gloves, high socks, the whole trip, man, to keep the sunlight off of him. Everybody laughed, including him, because he really looked like a ghost. But he'd be out there with his latest stand-up paddleboard or sailing canoe. And then one of the cancers invaded. Apparently he had had a ice boat crack up as a kid, and a slight crack in the bone under his eye, and the cancer invaded that, and they excavated several times and radiated the living daylights out of him to the point where it burned through to the roof of his mouth. And just about 3 months ago, the doctors told him he was clean. Well, a month after that, he developed a lump on his neck, and the lump turned out to be nothing, but they discovered that melanoma had metastasized in the rest of his body. So he really knew his days were numbered, but he didn't tell anybody. He went on for the next more than a month, just like nothing had happened. He was getting ready to enter the Everglades Challenge the next year, and he was telling everybody about the changes he was making in his sailing canoe. And then, damn it all, just a couple of weeks ago, we learned that he was in hospice care at home, on oxygen. And then just last weekend, we learned that he was very low, but it happened to be the weekend of the Great Lakes Multi-Hull Championships. It's a regatta that the factory has sponsored for years. Scott Brown and I have been there with his cameras several years ago, got some great video of Mead and Jan talking together, and then sailing with them in Adagio on Lake Huron. We should try to post that footage. Anyway, the word had gotten out last weekend that Mead was really sick, so they decided to move the start of the final race on Sunday from the mouth of the Saginaw River, where they usually start, over only a mile away or so to a beautiful little bay where Mead's home looks out on the water. Now, I wasn't there for this thing. I was told by Frank Starkweather, a former employee of the Goujons, who's a friend of mine, who called me up and told me what happened. All the multi-hulls lined up there in front of Mead's house. And in the fleet was Mead's famous old Adagio. Must be going on 50 years old now. And just this spring, Adagio had won the Port Huron to Mackinac race. Also there was Jan's trimaran, Ollie, and Jan's 50-foot experimental catamaran, the Strings, he called it. So these remarkable Goujon boats were lined up in the fleet, all anchored off of Mead's house. Mead has a neighbor who is a nut aviator who designs and builds his own wood epoxy airplanes, stunt aircraft. And so right before the start, here came this guy, zooming in to strafe the fleet and blowing Skyrider smoke. Now, I don't know for sure, but I was told that they moved me to the point where he could see out and watch this shindig. The race started, the boat sailed off in a big flock, the guy came in and strafed him again, did a loopy-doopy, and they went off to have their boat race, and by the time the race was over, Mead was gone. Well, it's a good thing I can edit this audio. I've been having trouble with this one, folks. It's hard to tell that story and stay straight. There's a lot more to it. I've been collecting comments by email over the last few days. I hope to share those with you perhaps next time I get around to making a caper. And in the meantime, I'm sure you realize that we've lost a real pillar in the marine community, who lived his whole life in pursuit of excellence, and he has left a very bright and happy stripe for us to follow. So, sail on, old friend. Sail on.